This is The Guardian.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Life is full of what-ifs, some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
The world's cities, full of vast megastructures and high-rise buildings, have long tried to push skywards, making the most of the spare vertical space available. But that's getting harder and harder, because they're also sinking, and fast. Recent surveys have found that nearly half of China's major cities are sinking. And now a new study has found that more than two dozen US coastal cities are dropping by over 2 millimetres a year.
Dozens of cities along the U.S. coastline are sinking at alarming rates. That's according to a report published in the journal Nature yesterday. New York City, Atlantic City, Virginia Beach, Charleston, and Savannah are among the cities sinking the most on the East Coast.
Then there's Jakarta in Indonesia. The north of the city is going down by about 5 centimetres every year. And it's already sunk by 2.5 metres in the last decade alone.
The situation has gotten so bad, the government is abandoning the capital and moving it 1,000 kilometres away, building a new city on the island of Borneo.
But that's nothing compared to Iran's capital city, Tehran. Some areas there are subsiding by 25 centimetres a year. And all this means that sea level rises could be a whole lot worse than we first thought.
So-called nuisance flooding is increasing, not just because the sea is rising, but because the land is sinking.
So today, why is the land beneath our feet sinking, and what can we do about it? From The Guardian, I'm Madeline Finlay, and this is Science Weekly. Manucha Sherzay is a professor of environmental security and remote sensing at Virginia Tech and director of the Earth Observation and Innovation Lab. He studies where and how quickly land is sinking.
Land subsidence is a big problem, driven by different processes, partly natural, partly anthropogenic or human-made. So natural processes mostly could be the tectonic processes that happens at a large scale at the rate of few millimeters, unless there is an earthquake that causes sudden change in the elevation. But the human-made or anthropogenic drivers include mostly groundwater extraction and oil and gas production.
While there are other factors at play, including the huge weight of modern cities, groundwater extraction, which is used for drinking, agriculture and industry, is one of the key reasons why so many places are dropping.
So groundwater is residing between porous spaces or empty spaces between the grains. So that water that is residing in these porous spaces holds the weight of the material above them. So as we extract the groundwater, the natural consequence of that removal of that fluid is that those porous spaces begin to collapse, which manifests itself into lowering of the elevation of the land on the surface. So, for instance, groundwater extraction causes land subsidence at a rate of up to tens of centimeters per year.
Rapid and significant land subsidence is pretty clear to see from the ground. Think wonky roads, leaning buildings with large cracks in the foundations, and even sinkholes. But more gradual subsidence isn't as easy to measure. It wasn't until the advent of satellite technology that scientists began to get a detailed picture of exactly how the world's land is moving.
In recent decades, our ability to monitor land subsidence has been transformed thanks to emergence of radar satellites. The sensor is mounted on the satellite, and this sensor transmits a radar signal, which is a microwave, and this signal propagates into the atmosphere and hit the ground surface and bounces back to the satellite. By collecting this return signal and measuring the time for the signal to travel to the ground and back to the satellite, we can measure change in elevation of the ground with respect to the satellite. We can estimate the rate of the land elevation change at the precision of almost about 1 millimeter per year.
Even in places that are sinking just a few millimetres per year, the cumulative effect can cause problems with infrastructure, like buildings and bridges, and underground structures like pipelines and sewerage systems. Even inland, a relative dip might mean that water can no longer drain properly. Of course, it's coastal areas that are the worst hit, including a place not too far from Manucha's Virginia Tech.
So one of the textbook examples, at least in USA, for hotspot of the land subsidence is Chesapeake Bay in Virginia. So that has the fastest rate of sea level rise along the Atlantic coast of the United States. And the reason for this accelerated sea level rise, in fact, is the rapid land subsidence. So what happens here is that we have a lot more flooding during the high tides. And also, there is another phenomenon that linked to the land subsidence, which is a sunny day flooding. It's when you don't have any high tide or there is no cloud in the sky, but the streets are flooded due to lowering of the land, but also elevation of the water table. Along the coast, we expect to lose a lot faster the land to the erosion, but also many houses will be uninhabitable due to flooding and inundation that's exacerbated by land subsidence.
The areas that are sinking are actually a relatively small part of the world's coast, but they tend to be where people live in large numbers.
That's Robert Nichols, the director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research and Professor of Climate Adaptation at the University of East Anglia. He's studied how the double whammy of land subsidence and rising sea levels are impacting coastal communities.
People are seeing maybe 2, 3, 4 times the amount of sea level rise that you might expect if you looked at climate change observations from tide gauges and what have you and satellites. It increases the risk of submergence or flooding, and land can actually end up below sea level so that it's not flooded. Occasionally, it'll be flooded all the time. It promotes erosion. It promotes salinization of groundwater and freshwater. So it has a lot of adverse effects. I think probably the flooding one, though, and the submergence is really the big effect that can really cause large damage.
Robert has also been looking at how cities are responding to rising sea levels and land subsidence. While Jakarta in Indonesia is currently one of the fastest sinking cities in the world, with areas in the north having already dropped 4 metres, there is another city that has sunk even further. Tokyo, Japan. Over the course of 50 years, Tokyo lost 5 metres in elevation, but then they managed to stop their subsidence. I asked Robert to give me the story of what happened.
Well, Tokyo is partly built on a delta. I think about 1 million people live on this delta. Tokyo is a city of about 30 million, so it kind of gives you the scale. It's not the whole city, it's just part of it. And as that developed in the 1920s, they pumped out lots of groundwater for drinking and use. And those deltaic sediments, the water's kind of holding up the sediments to some degree. So you take the water out and the delta sinks. And it sank up to 5 meters up to about 1970. That's the maximum. So it's phenomenal change. And quite a large part of that area now depends on dikes and pumps to keep it dry. It's below sea level. But in 1970, they thought, well, we don't want this to continue. And they started bringing in surface water from reservoirs inland. They provided an alternative source of water, and they outlawed the pumping of groundwater. And that essentially stopped the substance completely. And actually, the land has rebounded a little bit, but it's not a reversible process. Once you've had this substance, you really have to live with it. But they have managed to get a little bit of elevation back, but we're talking 10 centimetres rather than the 5 metres they lost.
So it sounds like a critical part of this is just stopping extracting your groundwater. But I wonder how feasible that is for all cities. You know, thinking of Jakarta, I wonder how many of their residents are using that groundwater now and how many other resources they can draw from.
I mean, I think this is one of the dilemmas. I mean, if you're going to do something about it, you need to have the means to provide that water. And it's also a kind of, it's a funding issue. It's obviously a resource issue, and it's a governance issue. Can you enforce that and people obey it? But I think probably one of the key things is for cities to encourage exchange between cities. That experience in Tokyo is surprisingly poorly known. And I think if you had cities discussing these problems and sharing experience, you'd probably find innovation and maybe sort of new ways of solving the problems emerging that we haven't thought of.
In places like Jakarta, where it might be more difficult to stop the groundwater extraction entirely, what other options are on the table?
The other alternative is adaptation. And the adaptations are the same ones you'd use against rising seas. And very simply, you can characterise adaptation as the choice between do we protect or do we move? And what you find in most cities, in fact, all cities really that have sunk due to substance, they have actually protected. And because I guess the cities are worth a lot of money, so therefore you can justify spending quite a bit of money in terms of defences and also things like pumping. You need to drain these areas as well as build a dike around them, because otherwise you'll have fresh water in them instead of salt water.
So you might want to move, or you might want to protect your city. I had seen, though, that there were potentially two other options. You could try and accommodate the water, or you could almost go on the offensive and try to push it back. Perhaps you could talk me through some of the options there.
Absolutely. Accommodation is an option where basically you accept flooding and you change how you use the land. So the classical way of accommodating would be to put your house on stilts. So you actually see quite a lot of that kind of construction in deltas in Asia. And in the UK, we're actually using that around our coasts increasingly. And that buys you time. I think accommodation, though, probably deals with, say, you know, a half metre, a metre of change. When Jakarta's gone down 4 metres and Tokyo 5, I don't think that option's available. This other option is almost advance, or you could say attack. I mean, I'm not sure. We often seem to use military metaphors when we're talking about these solutions, which maybe isn't the best way of characterising them. But that's building seaward and actually reclaiming land. And actually in Jakarta, for example, they are building a new area seaward of the city, and they're actually dredging material. They're coming in, they're building new land artificially with dredgers at higher elevation. And those are in areas that probably won't, as far as I understand, they believe will not subside so much. So they will help to defend the city behind, and they won't be so prone to the subsidence. So that is another solution. And it's more common than you think.
And what do you make of the more futuristic ideas that have been proposed, like floating buildings, even floating cities?
I think they're worth looking at. I think floating cities don't really exist at the present time, because I think they're technically quite difficult to build and there's lots of costs. And also, a floating city has got to be able to float under all conditions. And I think technically that's quite a challenge. But I think with rising sea levels and also this issue of sinking cities, we're bound to see people experimenting with these ideas. So, yep, I see it as an innovation that needs to be explored.
Do you think there's anything else we need to understand about land subsidence and sea level rise? Or have we reached the point now where we know what's happening, we know why it's happening, and we just have to crack on and deal with it?
I think we understand substance much less than we actually understand climate change. There's been 30 years plus of investigation of climate-induced sea level rise. With substance, it's quite a complex issue, and the knowledge is actually rather more fragmented. So I think there's actually quite a lot to be done. We have satellite platforms, and they can actually then track objects in cities or anywhere, really, as long as it reflects. And they can actually measure the relative change. So we now have a basis to understand what's happening. We don't necessarily know why, and we don't necessarily know what to do about it. So those two next steps also, I think, need to be looked at. We're going to have increasing areas situated below sea level. We often talk about natural capital nowadays, and I think it's maybe worth thinking about elevation capital, and that we ought to try and preserve elevation because it's actually a rather valuable thing to have. And if you lose it, I think you notice.
My thanks to both Professors Manucha Sherzay and Robert Nichols. If you listen to The Guardian's Politics Weekly UK podcast, which you definitely should, you might be interested to know that they're introducing new episodes with Pippa Creerer, The Guardian's political editor, and political correspondent Kieran Stacey. Every Monday, they'll be bringing you all the insight you need from Westminster to kick off your week. In the first episode, Pippa and Kieran chewed over the fallout from the local elections. Subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts. And that's it for today. This episode was produced by me, Madeline Finlay. The sound design was by Joel Cox. And the executive producer is Ellie Bury. We'll be back on Thursday. See you then.
This is The Guardian.
The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.